Magic is found in every room, where people connect over a shared purpose. In this weekly podcast, Luke, Hannah and Chris explore the role of purpose, courage, mindset and culture in every leader's quest for transformational performance.
Hello and welcome to Magic in the Room. I'm Hannah Breiderud.
And I'm Chris Province, and I'm excited for today. Today we are joined by my friend and someone that I know that you all will just have a wonderful time getting to know, Gene Allert. And Gene is the founder and executive director of two great organizations, with one being the Samaritan Women and the other for the Institute of Shelter Care. And Gene, welcome to Magic in the Room. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you both.
Well, just to kind of kick us off, Gene, would you mind giving us a little bit about the Samaritan Women and the Institute for Shelter Care and the work that you guys do every day?
The Institute for Shelter Care I'll get to next, but we started in 2007 as the Samaritan Women in the Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C. area as the first long-term restorative care program for victims of trafficking in that region. After over a decade of serving survivors in that very intense, long-term, close proximity kind of way, we began to realize that there was a need for services across the United States, and that gap was not being filled. We were being asked to help fill it. So we created the Institute for Shelter Care as a means of conducting research and training and mentorship to bring more people into the field of survivor care.
Okay. And Gene, when you say survivors, what kind of survivors are you speaking about?
So we work specifically with domestic survivors, so individuals who've been wounded here in the United States under the crime of sex trafficking. And so while human trafficking is a much broader category of offense, a large subcategory within the United States is sex trafficking. And so adults and minors who are harmed in that way.
Yeah. And it's such meaningful work. And I want to get so deep into the work that you guys do. I love it, hugely connected with it. And I'm fans of what, and we're fans of the work that you guys do every day. But, you know, what's intriguing to me is how all the ruckus got started, right? How, just kind of thinking about where you came from, your leadership journey, and how you ultimately got to this amazing place. So just a little bit of background. Man, so where did it all start? Where are you from originally? And then how did that take you to career one, right? Kind of take us through that journey.
Yeah, you know, there's no preparation for working in the field of sex trafficking, right? There's certainly people who have lived experience. I don't bring that to the table, but there was no coming up in the field. And even today, we don't have degrees in this topic. And so my journey went in all kinds of twists and turns. I'll say not so flippantly that you also had asked me about education. And in middle school, you know, when you take those little tests about what you're going to be when you grow up, right? Or what you have aptitudes for and that kind of thing. Well, you have to keep in mind that I'm a child of the 60s. And so there's also sort of a lens through which we looked at what women could do. But my tests always came back the same. And I think even if you took Myers-Briggs or something like that, it would still yield that my trajectory was going to be either teacher, minister, or counselor, right? That was sort of the box that my personality type fit in. I think what, as I danced through the journey very quickly, I think what you'll find is that I did not pay attention to the fact that there should have been or between those different titles. I thought there was and. So I ended up just pursuing all of them. And it looks an awful lot like being a female Forrest Gump. So here's kind of how it went in very broad strokes. Coming out of the Midwest at the time, I actually grew up as a child overseas, but primarily in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, but high school in the Midwest. And again, at that age, I was going to be a school teacher. So I started out being a high school English teacher and realized that the students and the parents were very taxing. So I moved over to corporate education, got my master's degree in education, and went down that track of was going to do corporate education, but I landed my first job with the CIA. So that kind of took another turn, and I started doing essentially technical training for them. But the funny thing, was I did my master's thesis on a Selectric typewriter. So I didn't have any of this like technical. And so they gave me a computer, a luggable, and told me to take it home and learn it. And so I started teaching on technology. And that led to becoming the IT director at AARP. Can't really explain that, but that's where that landed. And then from there, I pitched an idea about what we would today refer to as a portal. But back in those days, we didn't have them. And pitched an idea to a venture capitalist, and he funded it. So then I became a technology entrepreneur during the dot-com era. And then I had a little bit of a personal crash and thought that I was going to go into ministry. So I went to seminary and got a master's degree in divinity. And that led to my having kind of an awakening moment about the issue of human trafficking, sort of an intersection of my professional life and my spiritual life. And that led me to abandon all of that and start the Samaritan Women in 2007. So that was sort of entrepreneur meets ministry meets technology person. And so did that for the last 15, almost 16 years now. And with the Institute of Shelter Care, I've kind of come full circle because now I teach people.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So Forrest Gump, with or without chocolate.
Right. Yeah. I love that. I mean, just starting as a, you know, from education to corporate education to tech entrepreneur, you know, seeking out the ministerial aspect of life and then landing at a place that is hugely purpose driven. And I'm super interested in, you know, some of those key discoveries, you know, and let's kind of get to that. What, as you were going through your journey, what were those key discoveries that like said, hey, this whole thing about fighting trafficking and standing up for victims of trafficking, where did you find that spark that ignited this fire?
Yeah, I certainly wasn't looking for it. And I think that's one of the things that we just have to be open to in life is that sometimes the thing that makes you the most angry or breaks your heart is a calling. You know, we, some of us would like to think that the sky's just going to open up and a scroll is going to, you know, descend and we're going to give explicit instructions. And no, I just had a chance encounter with somebody on the streets of Baltimore and listened to her story. And it broke my heart. And I went into just an anger. Like, how does this happen? How does a 14-year-old girl end up here? And it so broke my heart, but it was kind of a shake your fist at God type of anger. And, you know, I think that that was for me, the catalyst of, well, if you're that angry about it, do something about it. And, so that was the catapult, to jumping in and realizing that there weren't resources for people like Heather. There was no place for her to go. And so it sort of befell upon me, like not really of my choice. Well, if somebody's going to do something, it might have to be you.
Yeah. Can you take us back to that day you met Heather, and kind of give the circumstance? Because people think it doesn't happen here. It doesn't happen to someone that I know, but like we know otherwise, but just what did you see or what did you experience that made you angry? What would take us back to that day,
sure,
if you don't mind?
Yeah, I was going out with this church group that was, you know, attending to people who are drug addicted and homeless and living in a very impoverished part of downtown Baltimore, just really rough. But, you know, there are these pockets of people that are trying to just bring some light and life into those areas. And so it was just sort of a tag along, like I'll go along to help, you know, in a non-committal kind of way. And then the encounter was waiting for me, and there was just something about her. She was absolutely wasted on oxy. She was just a tiny little thing, maybe 85 pounds. You know, she was sometimes coherent, but there was just something about her that drew me in. And so we sat on a stoop in this rough, awful neighborhood for about 3 hours. And one of the things that I learned in that encounter is that there are so many people who fly under our gaze. You know, we don't see them. They're the undesirables. They're the untouchables. They're the people you don't look at. You walk on the other side of the street. And probably in other times in my life, I would have done that. And just spending time with her and connecting lives, right? And hearing what it was like for her to be, you know, 13, 14 year old in this small town with a single parent, and she had Tinkerbell on her walls, and, you know, and yeah, everything wasn't great at home, but it wasn't bad. And then mom's boyfriend kind of is paying too much attention to her. And then he splits off from that relationship, but stays in touch with her, ends up seducing her to leave the home. And he traffics her up and down the I-95 corridor for about 4 years. And then by the time she's, you know, drug addicted and kind of used pretty hard, he just drops her back off. And now she's a very different person, estranged from all the supports, estranged from family, dealing with all of these other issues, no resources. And, you know, it's just the confluence of all of that. Like, where do you start? Like, start peeling the pieces away for problem solving. And I'm obviously an action-oriented person. And I'm like, is housing, is it education? Is it mental illness? Is it health? No, the answer is it's all that. And I think I liked the puzzle. I think I like big problems. And some of us do, right? Some of us need to go after problems that are bigger than ourselves.
Yeah.
Great. And I mean, at the time, what were the resources available? Where does a Heather, where do they go for help?
No, there really wasn't anything at that time. And that was back in early 07, late 06. There really wasn't anything available for her, certainly not in terms of restorative care programs. I mean, she could have gone to maybe a substance abuse facility, but what's she going to do economically? What's she going to do for housing? And so there's a way in which we sort of also keep these people stuck. And I think that part of that system problem also captivated my imagination is how do you break the cycles of some of these systems? And then, you know, spiraling into things like, well, why can't she go home? What's so changed, right? What bridges are burned or whatnot? So what's the lack of family support, social support, civic support that needs to be in place? And all of that, like I say, kind of captured my imagination as a big puzzle that needed to be solved. And so we've been chipping at it for years. I'm happy to say Heather's still in my life. She's married. She has two kids. She's doing really well. And, you know, she says quite poignantly that she's awfully glad that she was used as the inspiration, but she sure wished that there would have been something like Samaritan Women for her when she was out there.
Yeah. Now, ultimately, Jean, this kind of evolved into you converting, like finding property, doing restorative care on property. Kind of explain that process of, hey, this is me. I'm all about other people. I'm going to use what resources are available to engage in this purpose. Like, explain that process. Like, how did you decide, like, look, this isn't about me. It's bigger than me. I'm willing to, you know, I would use the term give till it hurts. Right. Yeah. And I'm willing to sell out for what I believe in. And just the story of courage there is what I'm really getting at, to say, it's so much not about me that I will give what I've spent my career acquiring to serve other people. And can you walk me through how you got there and a little bit about the process of actually doing it? Because the process of taking, you know, this property and creating restorative care from it. Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, you know that you've probably seen that little cartoon where the guy's at the chalkboard and he's doing a formula and then there's a gap and then he's got a formula and he says, like, insert miracle here.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that there's a big part of my trajectory that has a lot of insert miracle here, because one of the many, many stories that had to come together to make this happen was how I got the property. And, I wasn't looking for starting a home. I just wanted to help Heather. And, but a colleague and I were talking about, well, if we could secure maybe a little townhouse or something, we might have had a place where they could go. And as it turns out, we ended up driving around Baltimore looking for, where might we find, a little house that we might be able to do something. And we got completely lost because it was pre-GPS days. And ended up turning around on this property that it was just this moment where we pulled onto this property intending to just back out. And it was massive. And Baltimore has these all over the place where you're going through this sort of like blighted area. And then there's this big mansion, right? And then you'll be through this neighborhood. And then there's this big estate. And that was one of them. And so we had driven by accident onto this 23-acre historic estate with this 8,000 square foot Victorian and 4,000 square foot colonial. And it was just this abandoned historic estate. And we sat there in the road just kind of going, what is this place? Like, and that captivated our imagination. So we started making phone calls, find out that it's owned by this guy in West Virginia and he doesn't want it. And fast forward, we find out that there was an offer for $1.6 million on the property. Well, I did well in the internet space, but I did not do that well in the internet space. And so we arranged a meeting with the owner and said, he told him what we wanted to do and create this place of healing for women who've been in really tough situations. And he said, what can you afford? And we said, well, we could probably come up with about $500,000. And so he cogitated for a minute and he said, okay. So he walked away from $1.1 million and sold it to us for $500,000. So that was insert miracle number one. Mm-hmm. And, that's something that, yeah. So I paid the mortgage for, the first many years of the organizations. And so to your point about give till it hurts, it was like, well, I'm all in. I sold my company. I can't go backwards. Right. And so I was all in, but having no idea where in was going to take me. The other just interesting part of the story is about 7 years into doing the work, the gentleman from whom I bought the property showed up one day. He just wanted to check in and see how we were doing. And he was so impressed with what all the volunteers had done to renovate the place and how we were using it for such good that he ended up forgiving the balance of the note.
Oh, wow.
And, that's where you can't plan that. You can't go in and go, you know what, I'm going to be able to get this massive property for, frankly, what would have been the price of a townhome.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, I think it was kind of tying that back to everyone's leadership journey is if you know what the purpose is you're trying to serve, being idealistic about how you do it doesn't really serve us.
Yeah.
Right? Taking the right actions for opportunity to emerge. I think that's a huge leadership takeaway from this conversation is like, go take the actions and allow things to, to surface.
Well, and it's like that scene from the Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Where Harrison Ford just sort of steps out over the impasse and he doesn't know whether or not there's sure footing underneath, but he knows what his goal is. And I think one of the things that's been an interesting journey for me leadership wise is particularly when you do something like this, that has maybe a faith component or is a step out that people don't understand is they talk, I think, too much about your vision. Mm-hmm. Well, Gene, what's your vision for this? And like, do you have a vision? And, you know, the honest truth is that when you're in that front row seat, you don't know at all what the whole picture looks like.
Right.
And you have to just trust the parts you do know. Like the parts I know is I'm not going anywhere. The parts I know is there's more girls like Heather. The parts I know is that God can do amazing things if I move, right? And so I laid down what I knew, and the rest of it was like, no, I actually don't have a vision. I have no idea how all those right. puzzle pieces are going to come together.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, and just, you know, listening to your story, Jean, and it's fascinating, right? There's so many stories of transformation here, both for, you know, whether it's for Heather, whether it's for you, whether it's for this organization. And that's something that, you know, people connect with. And I think the stories of transformation, when we can share those, even more so than here's our vision, right? That's what people are drawn to and why some of us choose to do work that's different or unorthodox, or we didn't necessarily have a path to get there, but here we are. And I think it's one of the things that every human being is looking for, right? Transformation on some level. And there's so many powerful stories in baked into your story. And I really appreciate you sharing those with us today. My mind goes to Elise Lindquist, who is dubbed the angel of the prostitution district in Stockholm. My sister, Ruth Nordstrom, who's a human rights lawyer and heads up Scandinavian human rights lawyers, work really closely with her. And so just being able to see the kind of work in Elise's life, she was 58 years old before she embarked on this journey of helping others after having been a victim and grown up with sexual abuse, and now does incredible work in the prostitution district with victims of sex trafficking and sexual violence. And it has led to informing a whole, you know, government approach to that in Sweden, right? So it's the Nordic model on prostitution has been adopted by Sweden, Norway, Finland, most of the Nordic countries. And it started with someone being able to take their own story and be able to connect with people. In this case, it was St. Clara Church in downtown Stockholm, where Elise now is a, you know, volunteer and lecturer, and she travels around the world, and she's in her 70s now and is one of the most, you know, one of the most dynamic and inspiring people you've met, right? But it was because of transformation and being able to touch people's lives in such a way that it leads to transformation in so many other individuals.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's been also interesting to that point, Hannah, in my journey is because human trafficking was something that we didn't largely have as a dialogue here in the United States back in 07, it's made a lot of progress. So I did a tremendous amount of public speaking, right? You're always going to this Rotary Club or that church or whatever, right? And you're always doing that. And to a fault, somebody would come up afterwards. And what I found sort of bittersweet was how often it was always the same thing. Somebody would come up and say, oh, I'm so inspired by the work you do. I'm so, you know, and then flattery and all of that. But the next part of the conversation was, I've always wanted to do X, but I've held back.
Mm.
Right? What made you go forward and do it? And there was almost like this pattern of tragedy that I would see of people who had their hearts pulled, saw opportunities, saw need, felt they could step in, but they talked themselves out of it. And yet they're still so hungry to have that sense of purpose. You know, I have to say that since October 17th of 2007, I have not lived a day where I didn't know I had something important to do. I wouldn't trade that with anybody.
Yeah.
And I think that people come around that almost as if it's an aura, right? Or it's a fragrance. And they're like, I want some of that. I want some of that in my own life. And I remember having conversations with some women who would, it was women and men, but oftentimes it was a middle-aged woman. Mm-hmm. And she would say, you know, I just always wanted to do this for babies in Mexico, or I just always wanted to do something. And I'm like, do it, right? Just do it. And boy, if I had another life to live, I think I would just be the cattle prod for the people who are right on that. And maybe that's what you guys are doing, right? Is being that kind of catalyst to say, just Nike that bad boy, just do it.
Yeah. That's right. And you know, I kind of my key takeaway here from your, like from your journey is you made a decision that day to go with that group to that neighborhood. And I love the words, to find the people who were waiting to be found, not the ones that don't want found. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's what we go out there every day, whether we work in nonprofit, for profit, you know, are technically unemployed if we're consultants, whatever, like the nature of our existence. Like there's this idea of, do we have the courage in the face of this suffering called life? Do we have the courage to show up as the person we believe ourselves to be and find the people who are waiting to be found or the connections we don't yet have? Gene, a year ago, we didn't know one another, you know, and today we share a wonderful friendship in a care for your organization in the work that you do. And that's the whole idea, is like, can we be courageous enough to show up as the person we know ourselves to be? And that's what, I think that's what creates that gravity. You say it's almost like a fragrance. It's just drawing people to the things that we also believe in. That's what creates community.
And yeah, and I would say that there's something also that is a caution tape that should be wrapped around this conversation, because once you do adopt that kind of, you called it courage, right? To dare to go into those places that other people aren't going, and you realize how few are willing, that it feeds on itself. I just finished doing a study on an aspect of trafficking that was born out of just doing the work and realizing time and again, we kept encountering these narratives where these women had family members who were the actors in their abuse. And we know that childhood sexual abuse is upwards of 95% of what the victims have experienced prior to being commercially exploited. But I was just hearing and experiencing this, oh, wait a second, some of the girls we are serving still had family actors. So I started doing the same thing again, like going out and going, who's talking about this? Who's doing anything about this? Who's having this conversation? And it kept coming up pretty vacuous. So I said, okay, well, apparently that's the next void into which I feel compelled to step. And so as of today, literally, we're launching a national study that we did on familial trafficking. And it's something we often think of, well, that has to be, you know, that over there concept of third world countries. But this study yielded that parents selling their own children is upwards of 26 to 47% of the child trafficking problem in the United States. And so we're not talking about that. And we need to risk the unpopularity of that concept, right? We all recoil at that idea. But we also cannot at the same time tolerate that if there are that many kids being wounded by their own family members, right? Who's stepping into that and who's doing the work? So all of that is to say that I think there is a hazard to becoming very purpose-driven, is because then you'll see the next one and the next one and the next one.
Yeah. And yeah, so it is with a bit of reckless abandon, you know, like being purpose-driven is an all-in thing.
It is.
You know, and it's just, how do we find the courage? And that's why, Gene, it's important to hear your story and stories like this to give me courage, that says like, I can be fulfilled as well. And like, there's a pathway there that it starts with like getting really clear about what I believe and my values and what's the good that I think I can accomplish or I'm outfitted to accomplish and going forward with that work. But you know, you spoke to a few things there with like who gets trafficked, and we've had this whole not in my backyard, it doesn't happen in my neighborhood. And we know without a doubt, like there are people being trafficked into your neighborhood for purposes of sexual exploitation. There are people from your neighborhood going to areas where people are trafficked. Whether that's, you know, we know that the focus of TSW and Institute for Shelter Care is domestic, but you know, there's a lot of international trade where people from America go to Dominican Republic or go to other island countries or places that are less secure. And they basically treat exploitation as a vacation and exit the country to do that. So,
and there are people from other countries coming into the U.S. to rape our children.
Yeah.
And so it is, yeah, it is its own enterprise. Mm-hmm.
So we look at things like, so yes, let's accept that it does happen where we live. They just, everybody ad nauseum should accept that it happens in our communities, in our churches, in our neighborhoods, just wherever there are humans. Okay.
Right.
So we can't think that we're special around it. Now there are conditions that create, you know, definitely higher levels of risk for someone to be trafficked from. You know, the main thing is we see, you know, connections from extended family into a nuclear family where it's like, then it's the role of like when you have addicted parents, when you have absentee fathers, when like the protector of the home doesn't exist or the accountability of the children to adults in the home don't exist. It kind of creates this opportunity for a lot of outside influence. So like one of those red flags, anytime you see strong outside influence into a nuclear family, specifically the children of that family, it kind of raises a little bit of a flag. But, it, you know, take us through some, just some of those discoveries, maybe a little bit of by the numbers. What are the things that since that day with Heather, you've learned and you would like everyone to understand about this crisis?
Well, we should just sign you up as a public speaker there, Chris, because you nailed a whole bunch of the really important ones. As I mentioned earlier, being a victim of childhood sexual abuse is the most common denominator. I would say, statistically speaking, in the United States, the highest vulnerability is age. Children are just inherently vulnerable and dependent on adults. The most commonly exploited is a female. And so that's going to be in the high 90 percentile. But then we go into experiential factors, circumstantial factors like having been molested as a child. You know, we see in the United States that children who are exploited, 60% of them have been in the foster care system. And so that estrangement from a supportive family environment, the presence of substance abuse in the family, the presence of pornography in the family, and other criminal activity also ranks very high. You know, we have generational prostitution here in the United States, and so that's also something to be considered. I think what we're faced with right now as an interesting, and I mean that not in a complimentary way, terrifying social experiment is what has happened with all of these lockdowns. I mean, we're already seeing the effects of kids on their socialization with not only the separation and isolation that the masks present, but also just being distanced and not having peer groups and not and being online so much. So if we look at the confluence of things like social isolation, not having a support system, constant access to technology, which means constant access to anybody who has access to these tools. You know, there was an interesting study about Twitter that came out just yesterday in terms of it being a platform that is, you know, it's the number one recruitment platform for exploitation. Will that always be? No, because there'll be something even more heinous right behind it. But I think what we have to do is we have to look at, as we always say, this sort of confluence of factors that creates a perfect storm. a vulnerability. But I think one of the, to your point about takeaways, is like from where I look at the problem now, some of these are circumstantial factors that can at least be mitigated if we attended to having one safe person in a child's life. And so, yeah, fatherlessness, 70% of the time we see that in the victim population. And we know enough about statistics of where fatherlessness leads in a child's life, whether they're sexually exploited or not. But it really points back to secure relational attachments and having an adult in your life who assumes the responsibility for your care. And for as long as you need it, right? The more vulnerable you are, that might extend into your 20s. And we have perpetuated, I think, this trajectory of forcing kids to grow up way too fast. You know, we have laws right now. We have jurisdictions in this country where a 12-year-old can decide to be homeless. And the government in that jurisdiction doesn't do anything about it. You know, where we say a child in eighth grade can make life-defining decisions. And so that's separating that secure attachment of somebody in a custodial relationship, meaning really stewarding the best interests of that child. And we've done this in legal ways. We've done this sociologically. We've done this circumstantially, torn apart that fabric that has left children quite vulnerable.
Yeah. And I just think there's such a piece of this where, you know, as leaders, the minute we say, I'm a leader, we're raising our hand and saying, I'm going to take responsibility for the well-being of other people. Now, we all do that to different extremes. And Gene, what I appreciate is your willingness to do it all the way, right? And say, I'm going to take the people that need it the most, the people that are have been broken and violated and just have a difficult time trusting, and go through this process of restoration. And because, and that's my next question, is what is the process of restoration? Because as they appear to you, they may have criminal backgrounds. Like Heather, there could be addiction involved. The value of like traditional type of work isn't really there. Like there's this process of like, it's easy to make money this way. It's hard to make money any other way. So like how they show up to you, what is the process of restoration?
Yeah, well, so you asked earlier, what sort of what are the questions that capture my imagination? And fundamentally, as I've looked back over that Forrest Gump trajectory, what has always captured my attention is systems. So I look at everything as a system. Even relationships are systems, right? And so when I look at something like what is the absence of a system around Heather that allowed her to be more vulnerable to the exploitation and evil intent of others? And so looking at the relational patterns or lack thereof was a system that I said, okay, that we've got to keep our attention on that. You know, survivors would come to us from a variety of different ways, whether that's through law enforcement or the courts or corrections or medical professionals, mental health professionals, addiction. As we learn more in society, there are more pipelines to programs like ours. But that what is so fascinating to me and continues to capture my imagination is that each person is a puzzle. And each person comes in, some of them with the puzzle pieces permanently missing, right? I mean, that's sort of metaphorically and literally, like that's not going to come back for her. That's a permanent loss, right? Mm-hmm. And then to still be able to say, well, then how is there a process of architecture with what you have to work with? You know, we've had women who've come to us and they've come out of three generations of exploitation. And so they're steeped in a family system and an identity and a framework and a way of looking at the world and relational patterns. And so restoration isn't always starting from here's my box of Lego blocks and all I have to do is put them together well and I've built something. Sometimes it's dismantling things right? And there's a fair amount of the work that people don't want to hear about, but I'm going to dare it here, is sometimes you have to break something to make something. Mm-hmm. You have to break down patterns that aren't working. No, you can't steal or lie your way through life and expect a different outcome. So we're going to have to break some things in order to make some things. So I think that that's part of the work, is we have to have an appetite for the fact that deconstruction is part of construction, right? And anybody in the building trades knows that. But even I think in medical, right? Sometimes we're going to have to break that bone in order for it to be reset. And so we have to think that way about restoration. We also have to not have a naive idea about what success looks like. Right? Because we don't do that in parenting, right? Are you successful with one kid, but you're a hot mess as a parent with another? We don't know what the story is going to look like when it's fully played out. And so we can't be prescriptive to say, well, that means that everybody's going to get a 2-bedroom apartment and she's going to get her GED and she's going to get $15 an hour and she's going to get her kid back. And not necessarily. Right? She might be on the sex offenders registry and she can't have those kinds of jobs, even though she might have an aptitude for working with kids. And that's just dealing with the pieces that you have and what you have to work with. And so I would say we become in restorative care really good architects of possibilities, but ultimately she's got to build it. You know, it's got to be hers. And I think that's the other thing that people don't understand about this work, is they think if we just leverage enough community resources, we can build it for her. No, you actually can't. Just like you can't make an addict sober. Mm-hmm. You can't. Ultimately, you have to take somebody who has right now very few advantages, and you still have to stand over them and say, you're the one that's got to get up. You've got to have the will to get up. Because then we can help you with the next length. And so there's a great deal of what really goes on in restorative care that doesn't fit the happy narrative, right? That if we just buy them matching bed sheets and, you know, lots of Bath and Body Works products and like that, that's going to make it okay. And it doesn't even make the short list.
Right. Well, I love that. That systems approach. You know, we talked about a lot on this podcast about how one human body is a system, a group of humans, right? Whether it's a family, a classroom, an organization, are also systems. And, you know, we can look at when there's dysfunction in a system, right? There's always a victim of that dysfunction. So we look at the failures of the system. We look, those are the symptoms, but fixing the symptom doesn't fix the root cause. And looking back at what are the system's failures that are causing these outcomes, and being able to get to the root cause and healing and restoring that, I think that is a leadership lesson that applies in every kind of organization or every kind of system, right? Are we just putting band-aids on, or are we actually willing to look at the system and break it apart where it needs to be broken in order to rebuild a more healthy?
Yeah, and I'll give you an example of something that is just prevalent in our field. It's unfortunately an unpopular topic, but it's real. So we'll probably see about 40% of our population will be self-injurers. And mm-hmm. So we've got people who harm themselves. Well, so here you look at, you can't just come in and say, well, she has a disorder, right? She has a self-harming disorder. Okay, first of all, that doesn't help her move forward. We have to look at that as almost in a forensic kind of way, and first say, yes, of course, the goal is for the behavior to stop. But to just say stop it or to restrict the behavior might redirect that energy somewhere else, might manifest somewhere else. We've got to do two things. We've got to have the courage to go into the problem behavior deep enough to understand its origin. What is the impetus that keeps that behavior going? And we also can't go in there with a prescriptive mindset. We can't say, oh, well, I knew somebody in high school who was a cutter and they did it for attention. So everybody's doing this for attention. Mm. Maybe not so. Maybe this gal is doing it because she's so used to stuffing out all of the other feelings of her body that this was the only way that she learned how to feel. And so for her, it's not punitive. It's not attention seeking. It is for her a reward system of, I know I'm still human because I still bleed. Okay. I don't want to take that away from you. I want you to always feel human. I want you to understand you have life and vitality. But now we're on to something that's a totally different theory of why, right?
Yeah.
What is the purpose behind that behavior?
Right.
So we got to take the idea of purpose and we have to say, that's my I'm going to play with a number of theoretical frameworks to try to get to how has she made meaning out of that experience?
Yeah.
And then if that fundamental scheme of meaning is in error or is always going to lead to something destructive, we have to focus on reshaping that framework of meaning.
100%. And by the way, attention is one of the most fundamental human needs. And it is, if we do not get attention from caregivers as infants, we die. So the need for attention is hardwired into us. So if, and we talk about this in leadership, the most effective way to engage people is to pay a positive attention to what they do well. That's the essence of why feedback brings engagement, which is a little bit of a misnomer. It's the attention that actually helps people thrive. And so if someone is acting out just to get attention, well, let's look at that. Why is there a need, an unmet need for attention? Where is that coming from? Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you have to do it wholeheartedly. You know, like this, I love hearing Jean, you say, like, here's how we do it. Here's how the behavior manifests itself. And here's how committed we have to be to get to that cause. And I think as leaders of communities, organizations, families, whatever, we're always running into destructive behaviors being exhibited by other members of our community. But I think a key takeaway for me, Jean, is like being willing, like once you identify it, being willing to go deep enough to see the core, like what's at the root of it? What is the cause of the destructive behavior? And as a leader, we've already raised our hand, right? We have to be willing to explore the cause and not treat it topically with here's some Bath and Body Works. And this happens, I just want to tie what you do to most every organization on planet Earth. Like most organizations just want to put the M&Ms in the break room or buy some Bath and Body Works and everything's good. But it doesn't change the fact that there's this root cause for destructive behavior in someone's life that's, you know, showing up in an organization and damaging the performance of a community. Like someone has to say, I'm responsible for getting to that and addressing it in a structural way. And that's why this story of courage just continues to resonate. But,
well, I think there are just core principles. So remember I said there's no real academic preparation for getting into my field. But if you're a student of life, you will stumble upon or have them beaten into you sort of the truisms, right? The truisms of life. And one of them is that, to your point, Hannah, is that we'll go to whatever length we have to go to get the attention that we need. The other thing that I've learned out of this work, which I think is a truism and applies in a corporate setting or in something as dangerous as a gang, perhaps, is that when we get really deep with these women, and we have the privilege to do so, it always lands in the same place. And that is the need to belong.
Yeah.
And I will do whatever I have to do to belong to someone or to some people group or to have some sense that I matter. And unfortunately, we have such systems of isolation and estrangement that we feed right? Now you can't even find company at a Starbucks because everybody's got their earbuds on and they're looking at their phone. And so there's not even connection to be had out there. And so kids are going online to find it. And there are enough perpetrators willing to step into that. But that truism doesn't require, you know, a PhD in psychology.
Yeah.
Present company excluded, right? Like yeah. It does not require that to understand that. You can see that in your setting, yeah. Right? People will stay with a company because they know they have a sense of belonging there. And a woman will gravitate towards a toxic relationship because at least that's more tolerable than not belonging anywhere.
That's powerful. And, you know, taking it to, you know, just where my mind went and the, like, as it relates to exploitation of any type, but, you know, we can link it back to trafficking is, you know, as parents, when we're engaged on our phones or have our headsets in, I love that point. Like, you can't even get it out there. Like, people are going to Starbucks specifically to put their earbuds in, turn their computers on, and not connect with people in a coffee house. It's an amazing concept, right? But then as a parent, when I'm on my phone, when I've got my laptop open, when I'm otherwise engaged, not with my children, who are they connecting with?
Yeah. And isn't it funny that we have all of these seminars about mindfulness, right? You're supposed to, those are the M&Ms in the break room. And I'm not discounting it. In this work, though, you don't have to take a seminar in mindfulness. You learn how to be fully present because it's a fleeting moment sometimes that somebody who has been wounded, and I'm talking about people who could be walking around in your companies, right? Because there are so many people walking around wounded. That they have created a way of being that is so guarded that unless you're present, you miss the moment. And for many of our survivors, I would argue all of them, we had to be available when that moment presented because it was so fleeting that she was going to dare to risk one more time to let somebody in that little crack. Right? That just that little tender opening. And my goodness, if you were not wholly present in that moment, that door was slamming. And she was like, see, I've just confirmed the world does not welcome me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you end up unfortunately becoming a part of a recurring narrative that isn't taking her in a good direction.
Yeah. And well, I know, heck, the last 6 months for TSW and Institute for Shelter Care have been paramount. And I know you guys are really positioning to do some big stuff. So share with us, like, what are you looking forward to about 2022? What, you know, where is TSW going and the Institute for Shelter Care? How are you expanding that reach and ultimately touching more lives?
So we've taken what we've learned in doing the direct care and we've packaged that into instruction to help bring new people into this work because the problem's not going away. And in many ways, some of our social factors right now are showing us that the problem's only going to get worse. That's not being hyperbolic. That's just being pragmatic, right? And taking a look at the landscape. So we need to begin bringing in the next generation of folks who don't have to be nearly as pioneering as we were. And so a big part of the Institute is to help raise up that next generation of leaders, that next generation of people who will be wholly present in a broken person's life and help to be a part of that journey. So we do a considerable amount of training. Right now we're working with 17, I think if that number is right, startup agencies across the country that want to come into this work. We've got about 25 to 30 agencies who are already in the work, who want to do better, who want to raise the bar, who want to be able to gather more data, make better decisions, help learn from each other. And so we've been positioned as a national leader in the sense that how can we unify this field so we can get some groupthink out of our individual experiences? Because, you know, my generation of doing this work, we were largely isolated. We were so head down, you know, in our little community little Baltimore, but in our community that I didn't know what was happening in Houston or Atlanta or, you know, Des Moines. And so now we are at a place where we convene a lot of these leaders who've been in this field for a decade or more so that we can begin to have some of those more visionary conversations. In fact, we're hosting one in March where we're asking people to come together and say, what does this movement 2.0 look like? What are the things that are going to have to change in the way we do work? What does the survivor landscape look like? You know, the technology is outpacing our ability to be prepared. And so there wasn't sugaring and camming and TikTok and all of that when we did this work. And so we're seeing a very different kind of survivor coming on the landscape. We're seeing, for example, survivors who don't have the really sort of taken, you know, Hollywood kind of narrative, not that that was ever really factual. But now we've got, you know, this 22-year-old college student who, you know, was convinced that if she just turned a few tricks as sugaring, which it wasn't turning tricks, that's just escorting, right? And nobody will ever know, but you can get your books paid for and you can get your tuition paid for and you won't have to ask your parents for money. She's coming at this in a very different way, not even seeing, you know, at least the ones who grew up in generational prostitution kind of knew how this story was going to end. And so it's a different kind of victim that's coming onto the landscape. I think we're not prepared for that. And I could go on to that, but these are the kinds of things that we're studying at the Institute. What is the changing face of victimization here in the United States? What does the influx of immigration going to look like? How many of these agencies are prepared for multilingual services? You know, those kinds of things. So those are systems. Are our systems ready? What have we learned from the work that we've done? And can we do better research? Can we come together and share and learn and kind of expand our knowledge base? And then how do we invite more people into this work? But not just the people who are going to be the next, you know, Gene or Kim or Karen or whoever, but how do we invite Chris into this work? How do we invite the corporate sector, the academic sector, the lawmakers, advocate sector into this work in real partnership so that we can affect some systemic change? And so that's where the Institute is going. And our hope is that we will just continue to press into what's the next question that warrants our attention, and then do the same thing we've been doing for the last 15 years, which is throw your whole shoulder into that next question.
Yeah, love that. And you know, Gene, from the first time we talked, it's like once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah,
and it's one of those deeply human, powerful things. It's like, once I know that it's happening, I just feel compelled. Like I need to do something about it happening.
Right.
And it's this whole idea of like, it doesn't happen in my neighborhood. Oh yeah. You want me to tell you a story about what happened three doors mm-hmm. down from you, mm-hmm. you know? And it's just those sorts of realizations that create real gravity around this conversation. I think, you know, I just thank you for having it. You know, I've got, I've got 100 other questions, but the main thing I want to let people know, how do they get a hold of you? How do they learn more about TSW and Institute for Shelter Care? Just let us know. So can you let the folks know out there how to find you?
Sure. So you can go to either the domain of thesamaritanwomen.org, or you can go to instituteforsheltercare.org. All lands in the same spot. We do have a fair amount of information on how to learn more about trafficking. The bulk of what we have to offer is what does the landscape of care look like? I would say, though, that given the folks who listen into this podcast, a real appeal for those of you who are in sectors that are not this one. We need to form more creative partnerships with employers, right? With people who can offer apprenticeships, who can offer vocational on-ramps for individuals as a way out of poverty. And so we're much more interested in the long-term systemic partnership. Yes, of course, anybody who's listening can donate to what we're doing. That's right. that's easy and valuable. And thank you for any of you that are moved to do that. And really interested in having conversations like right now, these shelters would love to enter into a relationship with an insurance provider who understands our work and can help us put a good insurance package together. We've just formed a group of pro bono attorneys who are going to help with the unique concerns that happen, you know, within these shelter communities that can be very volatile, and we need general counsel at our disposal. I want to talk to people who can help us in education, right? Is there a way we could put services in place for GED, for community college, for vocational training? I think that there's some really exciting, I'd love to talk to somebody who owns like a national chain of consumer goods, because we go through a lot of stuff, right? And some of you have a stuff problem. And I am not asking your donors to start sending me clothes. I want a corporate relationship who's going to enter into a relationship with all these shelters across the country to say, gosh, every one of you does art therapy. I happen to have, you know, the country's largest arts and crafts store. Can we form a partnership where you guys get a 20% discount anytime you come to my store? Yes, we could do that. So I think the people in your audience who are excited about how they can leverage what they already do, mm-hmm. what they already do, and that connect a puzzle piece with what we do.
Yeah. And I think it just goes back to that theme of like rethinking our relationships and rethinking our resources and how can we utilize our resources to impact as many lives as possible. As we continue to do the good work, stewarding the well-being of other people. This is all so great, Gene. I leave every conversation we have so inspired, and I look forward to doing this again. I have questions about education and like the demand side economics of all this and just how that system is incredibly broken. And we can get into more of those specifics next time, but I'm leaving today inspired to, you know, to follow my heart and go show up as the person I know myself to be. Hannah, kind of key takeaways as we exit today.
Yeah. I mean, the big theme is the power of purpose, right? And when we connect with purpose, it might show up in a lot of unexpected ways, right? Because purpose is a higher order than the specific job that we have or the specific profession we're in, or even the context of our family or our upbringing or the path that we were on, right? Purpose takes on its own a life of its own. It's overarching. And when we are open, when we leave ourselves open to opportunity to see how we can connect our personal purpose with meaningful work, we may never know where that's going to lead us. And boy, there's so much room for transformation and really making an impact in the world if we are able to let go of maybe our preconceived notions of who we're supposed to be or what we're supposed to do in this world, when we connect to what is the impact I can make. And so thank you for sharing such inspirational stories of transformation, of really purpose-led work. And thank you for allowing us to be part of it.
My pleasure. Yeah, so everyone, I would encourage you to check out the great work that the Samaritan Women and the Institute for Shelter Care, see what they're doing, and just think about what you're doing, you know, how your community relationships are, you know, what resources are you putting into those, and how can we rethink things as we move through 2022 here, and just to advance that spirit of community. And how does my personal belief show up in the work that I do every day in making my community a little bit better and making the lives of other people a little bit better? And I think we take so many of those lessons away from today's conversation Jean Allert, thank you so much for your friendship, first of all, but secondly, for being so courageous every day. Just thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Okay, until next time. Thanks, everybody, for giving us a listen. Feel free to check us out at purposeandperformancegroup.com, or we're always here on Magic in the Room. Thanks, Hannah. Thanks, Jean. Bye-bye.
Magic in the Room is hosted by Chris Province, Hannah Brattaroo, and Luke Freeman, and produced by Ben West. Theme music is by Evan Grimm. Title track Fake Love, available on Apple Music. And this podcast was recorded at Storycatcher Studio, with video and audio editing and production support by Brad O'Hara and Alicia Crum, with inspiration, strategy, and technical support by yours truly, Neil Hughes. Magic in the Room is a production of Purpose and Performance Group. You can find us at purposeandperformancegroup.com. And remember, previous episodes are available at magicintheroom.com.